From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And as the big headline in the New York Times reads, breaking, U.S. gymnasts human. The women's gymnastics team seemed to falter in Tokyo, then came in second to Russia in the qualifying round. The U.S. men's basketball team lost its first game since 2004 to France. There are many victories. Swimmer Caleb Dressel led Team USA to a gold in the men's 4x100-meter freestyle relay, but a surprise for the women. So NPR's Leila Fadel is there. Start with U.S. swimmer Katie Ledecky in the 400 freestyle today.
I was expected to take that race, and it was quite an upset when her Australian rival Ariane Titmus beat her and took the gold. And Katie Ledecky said she fought her heart out for that race, and Ariane had a great swim, and as she won, we heard her shout out an expletive, kind of in shock, and they'll be going up against each other two more times in the races to come.
So that'll be something to watch. Ledecky, you know, set a record with the gold in Rio, so all eyes there. And we shouldn't, I mean, the U.S. is doing pretty okay overall. They're only behind China in the medal count. So what else are you watching? What else are people talking about?
Well, obviously, this is a very, very unique Olympics. The athletes are all performing without their fans. We saw Japan do really well in skateboarding, a new competition at the Olympics this year. They had winners in the street competitions, both men and women. A 13-year-old took that today, actually. One of the youngest Olympians ever, the youngest Olympian to take a gold medal for Japan. And obviously, upcoming women gymnastics. We're watching the U.S. soccer team and, you know, many more things ahead.
Well, and you talk about the, you know, not having spectators there. Are athletes saying that this might be affecting them?
I mean, they're not saying it's affecting them. They talk about missing, having that sort of roar of excitement when they do something spectacular. We just spoke about having a huge upset in a race where Katie Ledecky was favored to win, but the Australian competitor, she didn't have her fans in the stand. She didn't have her family in the stand. That's all happening virtually. I think about Ahmed Hefnaoui, a Tunisian. He took only the fifth gold medal for his country ever. He had the slowest qualifying time in the 400-meter freestyle race, and he won that race. And the only person cheering for him was his coach, totally in shock. Mm-hmm. Usually, you would see Tunisians going crazy. And so right now there's a lot of silence in these venues that were built for thousands upon thousands of roaring fans.
Well, it's so interesting because right now Tunisia is in turmoil. Could use that win, political turmoil. I want to ask you about the German women's gymnastics team. They've been wearing full body suits. They say it's to counteract the sexualization of their sport. There's been focus elsewhere also on what the female athletes are wearing compared to, let's say, their male counterparts. Talk about the outfits.
Well, this is an Olympics where women have used their platforms, right, to speak about their rights and the way that they are treated in professional sports. And so the Germans wearing the unitards to compete is something unique. And that's also not something unique only to their sport. When you think about beach volleyball, for example, there's been a lot of talk about what those players have to wear, the small bikinis in order to play. And they're asking, well, why do we have to wear this? And the male counterparts don't have to wear the same sort of tight and very small uniforms. And so that's been a big topic, not just at the Olympics, but in sports in general.
Well, you've been reporting, and we also reported on athletes who are mothers are using the games as a platform, speaking out against discrimination, the lack of help they have with childcare. What kind of changes do they want to see?
Well, I think it's about them just being visibly both professional athletes at the top of their game and mothers. So the most famous of which, of course, is U.S. track star Allyson Felix at the top of her game, most decorated track and field runner in history. And she's been very public since becoming a mother in 2018 about the brand Nike trying to pay her less. She ultimately split with them. And now she's given out grants to professional athletes who are mothers so that they can have people watch their children when they go out to compete. There are two Paralympians that I spoke to who are coming to Tokyo next month who got those $10,000 grants. And that, they say, it makes a huge difference. They don't have to depend on a hodgepodge of unreliable babysitters. It's also about more than that as well. You know, women have to deal with a lot of things that their male counterparts don't when they decide to become mothers. Their bodies are their tools. Can they bounce back? The hard decisions on breastfeeding. I spoke to a Canadian boxer, Mandy Bougeau, who ultimately lost her fight and is out of the Olympics now. But she had to sue to get here because she missed the qualifier because she had planned her baby. And so when they canceled the qualifier due to the pandemic, she sued because she wanted to be considered with her pre-baby ranking and ultimately won and got here. And so a lot of people are just trying to create accommodations for women and for professional athletes who are mothers.
Talk about some of the women athletes and the U.S. women's gymnastics team, which, again, you know, they qualified in the all-around, but, you know, you could see the looks on their faces like it wasn't as good as they wanted, and Russia surprisingly passed them by a full point.
They didn't do as well as expected. I mean, you think about Simone Biles and the things that she's able to do. They didn't do as well, but you saw them speaking about how they didn't have the best day, but they still qualified and they plan to come back.
NPR's Leila Fadden in Tokyo covering the Olympics. Leila, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's turn to Wall Street now, where all eyes are on the Federal Reserve meeting this week. Economists are watching closely to see when the central bank will begin scaling back its bond buying policies and how Fed officials are reacting to the rise of the Delta variant in the U.S. Data out later this week is expected to show the U.S. economy grew by about 9% in the second quarter of the year. Let's bring in NPR business correspondent David Gura. Hi there.
Hey, Celeste.
So there is a two-day meeting coming tomorrow. Based on what we heard in the June meeting, what do we expect now?
Yeah, we'll get this statement on Wednesday from the members of the Federal Open Market Committee. That's the group that sets Fed policy. Then there'll be this news conference with the Fed chair, Jerome Powell. And economists are not expecting a whole lot of news out of that statement, at least. Powell has been pretty adamant that the Fed is prepared to keep things as they are until the economy has recovered. That is to say, it's prepared to keep interest rates low, planning to keep buying billions of dollars worth of bonds to prop up the U.S. economy. And remember, the Fed's focus is on two things, principally on the labor market, getting the U.S. to full employment, and on keeping inflation within a target range. So what economists are going to be listening for on Wednesday in his comments is really any indication of when he and his colleagues would start to scale back that bond buying program. And consensus seems to be he's likely to give us more clarity on that. In a few weeks, there's a big meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, that the Kansas City Fed puts on. A lot of central bankers go to that, give big speeches. He's on the agenda. He's scheduled to do that as well.
And the reason that we're talking about bond buying is that Jerome Powell said the bank will not raise interest rates until it tapers down this bond buying program. Fed officials are kind of divided over when interest rates might go up, though. Why?
Yeah, you know, the reason for that division among policymakers is there's still just a lot of uncertainty about the economy right now. Obviously, it's been doing really well, but there are still millions of Americans who are out of work. That's one big concern. Another one has to do with inflation. We have seen prices going up on everything from cars to houses to food to electronics. And economists just don't have a clear sense of how long that's going to last, how sustained that inflation is going to be. So policymakers at the Fed, including Jay Powell, are waiting just to see what happens before they make a move, before they start scaling back those bond purchases.
So Thursday, the second quarter GDP data will be released. Economists are expecting to show that economic growth peaked during the spring. Why is economic growth slowing down?
This is going to be a big number. These are data from April through June when there was this surge in spending. People were going out. They were traveling. Businesses had reopened. We're going to see the kind of growth that we haven't seen since before the pandemic. You asked about kind of cooling off, and that number isn't going to tell us much about the future. There's concern that growth could slow in these coming months because of COVID-19. That's a big thing. A lot of worry about the Delta variant. Inflation is another. And then there are still these ongoing issues with the supply chain and what happens to the economy now that a lot of these government programs that were put in place in the early days of the pandemic are starting to wind down. I mean, right now, the economy has been humming along in large part thanks to some pretty big spending programs, both from the Federal Reserve, as we discussed, and also from Congress.
We have seen a rise in inflation. Some people have called them inflation surges, although Fed officials have said these surges are temporary in the inflation. Are they beginning to worry that these inflation rises could be not temporary?
You're right. What we've heard from the Fed chair and from the Treasury Secretary, from Janet Yellen as well, is that this is transitory, which is another word for temporary, that this has been caused by the economy being shut down and then reopened. It's just evening out, trying to figure out what's going on. But we are at this point where we're noticing them. A lot of what we're buying costs more, and no one really knows what transitory means. Again, yes, it means temporary, but how long is this period going to last? We don't have a very clear sense of that. And so there are layers of uncertainty on top of the fact that we just don't know how long this is going to go on.
And what have we heard about the effects of the Delta variant, at least on the economy?
Yeah, I've been struck by how many economists are nodding to the Delta variant. It's a thing that they're watching, but they're drawing a distinction between how fast it's spreading and what we went through last year. We've seen a few economists revise their forecasts for growth down a bit because of what we've seen, but most of them have not. So I'd say that they're paying attention to what's going on. The Fed is doing that as well. Jay Powell has said many times in the past that the virulence of the virus is what's driving the economy. Most economists expect continued growth through the rest of this year. Companies are hiring, people have saved money, they're spending again. And you got to remember, there's a point at which we're no longer going to see the kinds of numbers that we've seen. We've come out of this massive downturn. There has been this groundswell, Celeste, but economists say eventually that has to even out.
NPR business correspondent David Gura, as always, thanks so much, David.
Thank you.
The block I live on has been grieving a beloved neighbor. Priscilla Johnson McMillan, who almost made it to 93, spoke in hushed tones but was a powerful voice on local issues like zoning or global like nuclear disarmament. In the late 1950s, she and her husband George had a front row seat on the civil rights movement. Both white, he taught at historically black colleges. She befriended a young John Lewis, threw him his engagement party. Before that, as a young reporter in Moscow, she hung out with Truman Capote. He wrote about their friendship in his book, Muses Are Heard. Born into wealth, Priscilla McMillan lived modestly in Cambridge, Massachusetts. A scholar at Harvard's Davis Center for Russian Studies, she offered free rooms to budding scholars or the guy from the hardware store, or her by-then ex-husband's second wife. After George died, Priscilla brought his widow and young son in and adored them both. Oh, and she also knew well John F. Kennedy, beginning when he was a young senator, and Lee Harvey Oswald, who she met when he tried to defect to the Soviet Union in 1959. She was the only person in the world who knew both.
Here is a special bulletin from Dallas, Texas. Three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade today in downtown Dallas, Texas.
I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I heard the news from a friend, and I was just angry at the friend. I don't tell me that, you know, and I couldn't believe it.
Priscilla McMillan reminiscing in 2003. She spent 13 years researching the assassination, living with Oswald's widow, Marina, discovering that he'd once tried to shoot a racist segregationist but missed. So why Kennedy, who was working on civil rights?
He did like Kennedy, but as he saw it, his historic duty was to strike a blow or to bring down American capitalism.
Historians like Tom Powers declared her subsequent book, Marina and Lee, the definitive read on the assassination. Fiction bestseller Joseph Finder wrote a new foreword when it was re-released in 2013.
I write conspiracy thrillers. And while I was reading Priscilla's book, I realized there is no way that you can read this book and still, at the end, think that there was any kind of conspiracy. She has given us a picture of Oswald that is so close up, so fine-grained, that you realize he wouldn't work for anyone. He wouldn't be anyone's cat's paw.
Nevertheless, conspiracy theories sprung up and often included Priscilla.
I was probably about 7 years old, and she came to our house to visit.
That's Holly Catherine Johnson, one of Priscilla's many adoring nieces and nephews.
And she was on the phone. She kept saying, and looking very serious. And then she hung up and she said in her sweet little voice, "Oh, you have no idea how hard it is to get an error out of your FBI file." And I was just totally hooked. I thought she must be the coolest person in the whole world, and I just wanted to be her from then on. You know, decades later, I realized, like, how hard it is to get an error out of your FBI file and all the repercussions it had on her, both personally and professionally.
Holly is also a professor at Mercer County Community College in New Jersey. She's writing her aunt's biography, including anecdotes about her friendship with JFK.
One of my favorite comments was that he invited her to go with him to the Mediterranean, and she said, "I was about as likely to go as a fly, so instead I was replaced by a model named Pooh." on the
Every conversation with Priscilla McMillan holds a new gem. That portrait of her in bubble wrap in the closet was done by a well-known artist. She translated Stalin's daughter's memoirs, 20 Letters to a Friend, A Condemnation of Communism and Stalin.
It wasn't just she was helping with the translation, but Stalin's daughter wound up living with her and her family on Long Island. In her teenage years, she was on a plane that made an emergency landing that forced her to ride in a cargo hold of a Royal Canadian Air Force bomber. She attended Wendell Willkie's funeral. Khrushchev's son-in-law berated her in a bar in Moscow, and his mistress came to her aid. The number of improbabilities in her life are so numerous, but I think that Steve Aftergood, who's the director of the Government Secrecy Project, described it really well when he said that her home was like a kind of intellectual chemistry experiment. There could be everyone from the guy who mowed the lawn to like an international head of state at the same time. She never thought any voice was irrelevant. She'd throw out a question and let everyone have at it, and it was completely intellectually exhilarating.
So we wanted to hear again our conversation in that home through a door once always open. Here's our visit from 2003.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fine.
I have some tea on.
We visited Priscilla to talk over tea about her work as a speechwriter for then-Senator John Kennedy in the 50s, about their well-documented dating friendship. He pursued, she declined. And about how, as a reporter in Moscow in 1959, she met a 20-year-old American defector named Lee Harvey Oswald.
Well, I'd heard that there was a young defector staying in my hotel and that he wouldn't speak to anybody at the American embassy. A consular officer told me that. But he said to me, well, maybe he'll talk to you because you're a woman. And he said, yes, he'd come up and talk to me that night in my room. He carefully stood in the door of his room so I wouldn't be able to see inside.
Priscilla would come to learn that she and Oswald were both paying only $3 a day for their rooms. He, because he'd attempted suicide and the Soviets didn't know what to do with him. She, because the Russians wanted to recruit her to be a spy. There is a cottage industry in the U.S. of conspiracy theorists who believe Priscilla McMillan was a spy for the U.S., because how else could she have known both Kennedy and Oswald? Were you a spy?
No, I wasn't. But the thing that's so funny is that they think I was a spy for the U.S. Well, the U.S. never asked me. The Russians asked me.
They were trying to lure you in as a spy.
Sure. Yeah. But I wouldn't have spied for anybody.
What was your impression of him?
I thought he was lonely and lost and just very unutterably young.
Did you have any sense of, you know, anything bigger than that, anything grander than that?
At the end of our interview, he said to me, I want to give the people of the United States something to think about. Well, that's a little bit grandiose.
So he makes this closing remark to you, and then 4 years later, your first thought?
I almost knew, but I don't know why. When I heard Lee Harvey, I knew the rest of the name. But I, you know, how many Lee Harveys do you know?
Priscilla says she was in shock, then grief, and then traveled to Texas, where she befriended Marina Oswald and her daughter June, writing one of the definitive books of the genre, Marina and Lee.
I felt guilty because I'd known Kennedy and I'd strung him along all those years, maybe four. And the thing that I remembered best about him was that he was curious about everything, and he was always asking me questions. So, naturally, I thought, he want to know why somebody who didn't even know him hated him enough to shoot him. And so that's what I was after. I wanted to find out for him, for his sake, why he was killed.
Are you saying that your intense interest in all the research that you'd done, all the work that you did, the testimony before the Warren Commission, all your sort of immersion in this whole topic, are you saying that it's in large part because of a commitment that you felt to Jack Kennedy?
Yeah, that sounds a little bit grandiose, but I really wanted to explain to him why he died. Yeah. A lot of the time when I saw him, he was in the hospital for ruptured and crippled in New York. And I knew that he had Addison's disease, and I really grieved over it, although I was trying to cheer him up. And so I saw him fighting for his life, and I knew that his life probably wasn't going to be long. That was the state of his treatment for Addison's disease. But I did want to explain to him why he died.
Do you ever find yourself struck by, he was killed by someone you knew?
Well, I'm struck by how somebody quite small and insignificant was able to cut down somebody who had sacrificed and worked so hard to be president. At the contingency of history, Marxism, which Oswald said he believed in, claimed that the individual didn't matter in history. And yet, he proved that the individual does matter. I have wondered how our history would have been different if it weren't for Oswald. Yes, I wish Kennedy had lived out his time, because he surely would have done some good things.
Historian Priscilla McMillan in 2003. She died July 7th, just short of her 93rd birthday, the only person who knew both JFK and his assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald. She wrote what historians have called the definitive book on the assassination, Marina and Lee. She was also the definitive neighbor. At her funeral, the Reverend Mark Fitzhugh marveled at her open door, come sit by me policy, her generosity of spirit. If only, he said, Lee Harvey Oswald could have spent more time with Priscilla Johnson McMillan.
The Indicator from Planet Money is your daily source for economic stories, stories that peel back this onion we know as the U.S. economy. Today on the show, desperately seeking construction workers. Forget everything you thought you knew about the unemployment numbers. 10 minutes or less, that is all it takes for us to explain what is going on with all those numbers. Listen and follow The Indicator from NPR.
It's Here and Now. After years of controversy, the Major League Baseball team out of Cleveland announced last week that it will now be the Cleveland Guardians. While the choice of Guardians may have baffled some, the name was inspired by one of the city's most iconic landmarks, a set of towering statues known as the Guardians of Traffic. David C. Barnett, senior arts reporter for WCPN's Idea Stream, Cleveland local and an institution himself, is here. Hi, David.
Absolutely. As we are both, right?
Well, the name that's being dropped, as inappropriate as we know, was Cleveland Indians. The team decided to pivot away from names with a Native American origin and cut ties with the controversial Chief Wahoo. But we'll have pictures at hereandnow.org, but for the uninitiated, Guardians of Traffic, what is that?
It is on a bridge that crosses the infamous Cuyahoga River. It links east and west. The statues date back to 1932, and there are four pylons on the bridge, two on the west side and two on the east side. Each one of these pylons has this guardian on it, and what the guardians are doing is holding a mode of transportation, everything from a stagecoach to a hay wagon, to a brand new car, circa 1920 or so, and several trucks. And so each one of these guardians is holding these vehicles, and is in a way kind of blessing the traffic that goes back and forth across the bridge. They're done in an Art Deco style, and they're beautiful to look at.
Gorgeous, gorgeous. As again, herenow.org to see them, but. How will that translate into a T-shirt?
Well, there's been some question about the logo itself because it's the logo they've come up with is a little clunky. It's a baseball with a couple of wings on each side, which kind of emulates the way the Guardians look. But I got to tell you, the Guardian imagery is all over town. It is on T-shirts. It is on beer bottles. It is on even shower curtains, and not to mention, you know, paperweights and bumper stickers and buttons and that sort of thing. So it's really part of the, you know, to be corny, to be part of the DNA of the city, but it's so true.
No, I think that's a wonderful way to put it, and this city has deep, rich DNA. How are people feeling about the change?
Well, there's a mixed reaction, I'll put it that way. But I think it's trending towards positive. The critics will argue that their childhood memories are being erased, or some might say canceled. Others say that logo is bad. But the adherents are saying that the Guardians are iconic, and they have a long history, and they are Cleveland. They are noble. They are strong. And what's not to like about that?
Right. What is not to like? Has the team, you know, have they come? Can you see the logo now with the team? I mean, as you said, it's all over town, but
not
can
yet,
you get
not
it like on
yet,
a hat?
Because it's due to be introduced in next year. As you may recall, in recent years, Chief Wahoo went away several years ago, and so they've been phasing it out, and so that they finally have phased out the name Indians.
Okay, well now it's Guardians of Traffic and Athletes.
indeed,
David C. Barnett. I'm sorry.
I'm glad that it's happening, quite frankly, and I got to say, go Guardians. First time I ever said that.
Nearly a third of all pandemic deaths in the U.S. have been in nursing home and long-term care facilities. That's according to the New York Times. That's why that population was prioritized early for the vaccine, and a high portion of those residents are now vaccinated. But that's not the case for the people taking care of them. ProPublica reports that more than 40% of nursing home and long-term care workers have not been vaccinated. Here to give us more details is Jenny Deem. She's been reporting on this with her colleagues, and she covers healthcare for ProPublica. Welcome, Jenny.
Well, thank you for having me.
We've heard a lot about common reasons for people to not get the vaccine, things like worrying that the vaccine was developed too quickly and the approval process and also the fact that it's been politicized. What did you learn about the reasons why nursing home staff are not getting vaccinated?
Well, I think that the reasons are varied, just like the reasons for people who are unvaccinated in the general population. As someone in the story, one of the nurses said, nurses are people too. These workers, they live in the communities. They listen to certain television, or they get their news off of, you know, from certain places that are skeptical of the vaccines. And so it's very hard to, even though you would think that a healthcare worker might have a different perspective than the public at large, it wasn't the case. And the people that we talked to are pretty intractable. They just said absolutely not.
It is surprising that among healthcare workers, 40% would have not even one vaccination. But I'm wondering what the risk level is, because we do know that among Americans 65 and older, around 90% have at least one dose of the vaccine. So can we assume that many nursing home residents are at least protected by their vaccine?
Well, I think that they are somewhat protected. The concern is that people who are in nursing homes, who are in long-term care facilities, they're there for a reason. They're there because they need that extra level of medical care. They have underlying health problems. They have perhaps compromised immune systems. And one of the things that the medical experts have said all along is that while the vaccine is very effective, if you have those problems, it is not going to give you the same level of protection.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of fear that, especially with the Delta variant, even if they are protected, I mean, even if they are vaccinated, they may not have the same level of protection that the general population has. These people are, it's a very vulnerable population.
Yeah.
And the concern is that the workers who come in, who come in from the communities that have high levels of unvaccinated people, come in and bring the Delta variant in, and it makes the residents susceptible. We don't really know what that's going to be yet because it's all too new.
And I mean, we just have to remember that a vaccination is not like bulletproof glass. You can still get the COVID-19
Correct.
Virus.
And yeah. I think we're seeing that.
Yeah.
But I think there is an added concern for very vulnerable populations, like nursing homes.
I'm sure that many people think, well, perhaps you could mandate vaccinations. You quote Lawrence Gostin, a health mm-hmm. law professor at Georgetown University, who said nursing homes have both the power and duty to require vaccinations. What did you learn about whether nursing home operators can mandate vaccinations or not?
Well, it's interesting because just today, about 50 healthcare groups in the United States, including the AMA, American College of Physicians, American Academy of Pediatrics, have all come out in favor of mandates. But it's tricky because although the EEOC has said that employers do have the right to mandate a vaccine, you know, barring, you know, provisions for religious and medical exemptions, even though they may have the right, there is a big resistance in this particular industry because they are very short-staffed. There's a lot of turnover. These tend to be low-paid workers, and nursing homes are worried that if they start mandating, that they will lose staff and they won't be able to replace them.
Jenny Deem is a healthcare reporter for ProPublica. Jenny, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Since May, sick and dead songbirds have been reported in the eastern U.S., as far west as Indiana. Wildlife officials are asking people to take down bird feeders and remove bird baths to potentially stop the spread of the mysterious illness if it's contagious. Andy Kubis of the Allegheny Front has more.
Cindy Fink's yard in Moon Township, just north of Pittsburgh, is small, but she gets a lot of bird visitors, attracted by the buffet of choices she provides.
Sunflower seed, and then I have a bird bath. I feed them nuts and some suet. I have a couple bird houses. This year I had a chickadee nest in one of the houses, which was really fun to watch.
This is the part of the story where you normally hear the sound of birds from Fink's yard, but not this time. That's because she's taken all of her feeders down and emptied the bird bath after seeing an alert on Facebook.
When I first saw it, I said, oh, that's silly. My birds are fine. But then I kept seeing it in more places and the Game Commission and all over the place. I said, I better stop because I don't want them to get any sicker than they may already be.
In late May, wildlife managers across the mid-Atlantic began receiving reports of sick or dead songbirds, mainly blue jays, starlings, and grackles, but also robins, cardinals, and others. The hope is that removing feeders will prevent birds from gathering and possibly spreading disease. A couple weeks ago, before she took her feeders down, Fink found a dead bird in her yard.
But I was walking out to my mailbox, and there's always robins out in my yard, and there's one just belly up in the middle of the lawn.
Rachel Handel of the Audubon Society of Western Pennsylvania says people should be on the lookout for certain signs of disease, like crusty eyes.
The birds who are showing symptoms of the illness have conjunctivitis or neurological problems, so they perhaps seem disoriented.
The Audubon Society recommends to avoid handling dead birds and keep pets away. Meanwhile, researchers across the country are trying to figure out what's going on. The Wildlife Futures Program at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine is helping track the numbers with an online bird mortality form. As of July 8th, they'd received 1,679 reports from 10 states, most of them from Pennsylvania. Dr. Scott Weber is with the Wildlife Futures Program. His lab has been conducting bird autopsies and a variety of testing to try to solve the mystery.
So that testing has included looking at for different toxins, looking for different bacterial diseases, different viral diseases. We also looking for parasites.
Weber says the most likely cause is a pathogen or virus. It's just a matter of finding it.
Especially if it's a new emerging disease where the pathogen hasn't been identified before or cultured before, if in some cases of infectious diseases, they just can be very difficult to get out. And the other important part is too, is that we want to make sure that any pathogens we do find are consistent with a lot of the cases that are being submitted.
So far, researchers have ruled out some of the known bird pathogens like salmonella, bird flu, and West Nile virus. One theory out there is that it has something to do with the brood 10 cicadas that emerged this spring.
We have looked at, for instance, a toxin that was infecting the cicadas. I believe that they haven't found that toxin in these birds. The other thing is that we're looking at some of the pesticides used to control cicadas.
Weber says that disease spreads like this do happen regularly. Just this past winter, songbird deaths were linked to a salmonella outbreak. And while there is concern for alarm, he feels confident researchers will be able to find the cause. In the meantime, people should not worry about birds having enough to eat without feeders.
There's ample food out there for them at this point in time, so they shouldn't have any problems.
Not having them around is very strange.
Again, backyard birder Cindy Fink.
I work from home now, so I'm home all day, so it gives me a little something to look at when I'm taking a break from the computer, and there's nothing to look at anymore. And I think the cats are a little sad, too.
Fink says she just hopes they figure out what's going on soon so she can start feeding her birds again. For Here and Now, I am Andy Kubis.
And as protests continue in Cuba, Cubans here in the U.S. are taking to Washington, D.C. to do the same. Yesterday, hundreds from all over this country gathered in front of the White House, shouting their demands to President Biden to do more. Freedom for Cuba. Many of the protesters came from South Florida, and many more are expected to arrive in Washington today, a national holiday in Cuba commemorating the start of the Cuban Revolution, which ushered in the communist leader Fidel Castro in 1953. Let's bring in Alex Dougherty, Washington correspondent for the Miami Herald. First of all, we can hear there's quite a bit going on there. Describe what's happening.
Yeah, it's a scene of honking at the moment. There are folks gathered in Washington, or at Lafayette Square Park just outside the White House, which was closed for the better part of a year after Black Lives Matter protests reopened about a month or two ago. And there's kind of caravans of folks driving around downtown D.C. as we speak, waving Cuban flags, honking, basically demanding freedom.
Well, and tell us who they are, because I don't want to paint Cubans in America with a broad brush. Many, you know, fled Castro and the revolution, have been resentful, have not wanted any ties with Cuba. Others have wanted to open relations even before the Castro regime ended. So describe who's there and what they want.
All the people I've spoken to so far, both last night and today, arrived in the United States from Cuba. They were born in Cuba and obviously are opposed to the Castro regime, opposed to communism, and opposed to everything that is going on. Awesome, thank you. Sorry, a protester just interrupted me to tell me that his daughter had just fled in a boat from Cuba a few years ago, overhearing
wow.
my conversation. And so these are people who are opposed to the embargo. These are people who are opposed to any kind of reopening with Cuba as long as the communist regime exists. So that is the general sense of what they want from Biden. They want a strong response from Biden, but they don't want going back to what Barack Obama did in Cuba and attempting to reopen more relations. They basically want the United States to support and in some cases intervene to help promote democracy in Cuba.
Well, President Biden announced plans for targeted sanctions on Cuban regime officials for their involvement in the crackdown on protests there. Now, we know the U.S. has long had economic pressure on Cuba's government, despite easing that during the Obama era. What can Biden do?
So that's where his options become a lot more complicated. In terms of the targeted sanctions that were allowed, you know, put out last week, there was some point that, and I think you alluded to it there, the ongoing embargo kind of makes the sanctions not as forceful as they might be for another country that we have normal economic relationship with. And so I think for most of the people here, what's happened so far is not enough. There isn't really a single theme as to what Biden should do. There's differing opinions among the people who are here. I talked to someone last night who described what he wanted to see as a humanitarian intervention. He didn't want to see the military coming in by force, but he wanted the United States and other countries to physically come into Cuba with supplies and with things like internet to help pro-democracy protesters without actual military intervention. And he didn't want it to just be the United States. He said, ideally, this would be, you know, many different countries, but the United States should lead. Other people are much more forceful in saying, look, like, we went into Iraq and Afghanistan, we should do the same to a, you know, regime that is 90 miles from our shore and send in the military.
And meanwhile, we just have to note that at least one protester felt free to come up and talk to you while broadcasting to say that his daughter had just recently fled Cuba. For him, obviously, this is not something from the past.
No. And everyone I've talked to has either direct or extended family members still in Cuba. Some of them have been in contact with their family members since the July 11th protests. Others have not. And they said they're afraid to contact people. If they're seen as, you know, an advocate for democracy in Cuba, they don't want to put their family in harm's way. Or their family is afraid to, you know, talk to or communicate with them because they're concerned that the government, you know, may be listening to their conversations or otherwise spying on them in some way. But it's not just a, you know, ideal of, hey, you know, I'm from Cuba and I want democracy. It's also, hey, my family is there and, you know, they want freedom, not just food, not vaccines, but freedom.
Alex Dougherty, Washington correspondent for the Miami Herald, there in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we are so glad that you are listening to us on your local public radio station or website. You can keep the conversation going on Twitter. You can find me at Here and Now Robin. Our co-host, Tanya, is at Tanya Mosley.
And I'm at Celeste Headley. And get to know the team that puts the show together every day. You'll find all of them at hereandnow.org. Just click Meet the Staff.
They are a noble group. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is Here and Now.